This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 147, Orpheus. Last time, we wrapped up the reign of King Antiochus Soter with a discussion of his family, his death, and the new imperial dating system, the Seleucid era. As I said at the end of that episode, I am sure there are enough short-lived kings who didn't get their full religion episode treatment that I can justify spending 3 episodes on religion topics right now. So today, we are going to build up to one of the more interesting religious developments in Zoroastrianism and the Hellenistic world from an unlikely starting point. The Greek mythological character Orpheus. I promise this will all tie together at the end of the trilogy, but for now, I need to introduce the man, the myth, the legend, the bard, Orpheus. I want to start with a reminder about the relationship between mythology, religion, and belief in the ancient world writ large. Whether we are talking about Greeks, Egyptians, Babylonians, Indo-Iranians, Han Chinese, or yes, even the Judeans, ancient people tended not to be quite as committed to the whole package of their faith as modern Abrahamic religions that dominate most of the world. There was not a central religious authority to canonize things in any of these cultures. People disagreed about which stories were true and the spiritual lessons they conveyed, if they conveyed a lesson at all. And not every story about the gods or mythical heroes had to convey a lesson. Sometimes they were just about the divine, or even just inspired. Thus, we have a situation where most ancient Greeks and Romans, with Aristotle as a notable exception, believed that Orpheus was a real person who lived sometime before the likes of Homer and Hesiod. This is not the same as the historical Greek Dark Age or the earlier Mycenaean and Minoan periods in the Bronze Age. While Greek myths preserved some vague understandings of those periods, they were not accurate historical accounts. Greek mythology follows a timeline all its own, and even then, it's often only consistent within the works of a single author. If that. So, With the disclaimers out of the way, modern historians generally agree that Orpheus was not, in fact, a real person. Now, while many mythological characters with connections to the gods were effectively just that, storybook figures with no greater significance to organized religion than a parable at best, or a priest and a rabbi joke at worst, Orpheus gets a little bit more complicated. That's why I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes talking about him and not one of the many cameo appearances in this story. By the classical period, most Greeks thought of Orpheus primarily as a bard, and really as the bard, the greatest composer of poetry and songs ever to live. At least one ancient author suggested his name was a portmanteau of oraiophonos, meaning the best voice. The more likely etymologies hint at the darker turns in his story, either coming from the Greek word orphanos, an orphan, or just fatherless, or possibly orphne, the darkness. The specifics of Orpheus's origins depend a lot on which ancient mythographer you happened to ask. Some, especially later sources like Strabo, claim that Orpheus was the son of Oeagros, a Thracian king by some accounts, or the Thracian equivalent to the god Dionysus, according to others. Oeagros is usually depicted as somehow divine, if not a god himself, then the son of a god, or at least a nymph and another human king. In other versions of the tale, Orpheus's father is Apollo, the sun-adjacent god of archery and music, which makes sense given Orpheus's bardic career. In most versions of the story, the musical angle also comes from his mother. Whether the father is Oeagros or Apollo, Orpheus's mother is usually depicted as one of the nine muses, the goddesses that governed the arts. Which does mean that in at least one variation of the tale, Orpheus is technically a god himself, as a son of Apollo and a muse, just a very minor god, all things considered. Usually, his mother is Calliope, the leader of the muses and the patron goddess of epic poetry, like the Iliad and the Odyssey. Though at least four other muses were suggested over time, usually depending on which specific aspect of Orpheus's art the author was focused on. And if 5 out of 9 were suggested, I would guess that there were probably variations to cover the other 4. In another version of the story, from Pausanias, Orpheus was the son of Apollo and one of the Pierides, a group of 9 mostly human daughters of King Pyrrhos of Emathia, a region in Macedon. At a glance, Pausanias was Macedonian, and this could just be a local variant of the Muses' story. However, when he is depicted as a mortal king, Oeagros is usually associated with Edonia, a Thracian territory just outside of Macedon's pre-Persian borders, and therefore part of the classical kingdom of Macedon, or even Pieria, a Macedonian region named for the aforementioned King Pyrrhus. Pyrrhus himself is said to be Oeagrus's father in some versions, and not coincidentally, Apollo was also one of the most important gods in ancient Macedon. All of this to say, there is a pretty good chance that Orpheus originated as a Macedonian hero, and the specific Thracian identity only came after Macedon was more Hellenized and felt less foreign to the Greeks. The point is that Orpheus was not Greek, but very close. And even though he became popular throughout Greece, it should be no surprise that his story suddenly became more important to the history of Persia under Macedonian rule. I'd love to talk more about the stories of the distinctly ancient Macedonian branch of mythology, but at a certain point, it feels like the authors just had a list of names and character outlines that they stuck together in their family tree at random. As a young man, whether his father or not, Apollo visited Orpheus. He gave the boy a golden lyre and taught him to play music. By some accounts, Apollo also taught Orpheus's brother Linus, and the pair set out to bring music and education to the Greek world. Linus's career was cut short when he was enlisted to teach the hero Heracles how to play music, which ended in the greatest hero of the Greek world flying into a rage and beating his music teacher to death. Apparently, this did not breed animosity between Heracles and Orpheus, as we will see later. Orpheus had more luck, most famously teaching the Phrygian king Midas of Golden Touch and Gordian Knot infamy to play the lyre. Diodorus says that Orpheus's time as a traveling bard even took him to Egypt, where he studied the Egyptian gods. The thing is, Orpheus wasn't just spreading a love for music. He also studied the ways of religion and the stories of the gods and how best to worship them, composing hymns of praise and teaching people to worship new deities as he went. He is used as a reason for how different cults spread around the Greek world. Amongst other examples, he introduced the people of Aegina to Hecate, the goddess of magic. He introduced the aspect of Demeter as a mother in mourning to the Spartans. And he taught the pre-Greek natives of Tegetos the Eleusinian mysteries. According to tradition, Orpheus also generally spread his own writings across the world in a wide array of poems praising the gods with similar themes, all written in dactylic hexameter, the preferred verse form of ancient Greece. Speaking of epic poems, the story of Orpheus really expands with two versions of the same epic, the Argonautica. This is, to most people, the story of Jason and the Argonauts on their quest to find and retrieve the mythical Golden Fleece in the far-off land of Colchis. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. The general story of Jason and his crew of heroes circulated long before the version that is most famously written down. The most famous example of these earlier versions preserved in writing is probably the play Medea, which is set just after Jason recovered the fleece. Ironically, or maybe not, the most famous version was written by the poet Apollonius of Rhodes right at our current point in the narrative, acting under the patronage of Ptolemy II. In the centuries that followed, several other Argonauticas and shorter retellings of the myth were composed and preserved, including one from the 4th century CE that recast Orpheus himself as the author and co-main character to Jason. That said, it is worth pointing out that Orpheus is one of the only heroes who appears in all of the ancient versions of the story, and is actually the name that comes up second most frequently even in Apollonius's version. His time with the Argonauts is also consistently referenced in other descriptions of Orpheus's life. The Argonautica is one of the most fascinating ancient Greek myths, both because Apollonius's original version is one of the only surviving Hellenistic-era epics, and an interesting deconstruction of traditional epic poetry in general. The Argonautica is also just interesting because it is essentially the ancient equivalent to the Avengers or the Justice League. What if you took everyone's favorite heroes from their own long-running series of myths and did one gigantic crossover? That's the Argonautica. Highlights of the crew include Jason and Orpheus, of course, Heracles himself, the horse-riding twins Castor and Pollux, a young Nestor, better known for his role in the Iliad and Odyssey, the fathers of both Ajax and Achilles, and the angelic brothers Callias and Zetes. Though he isn't on board in Apollonius's version, other variations include Theseus, who slew the Minotaur. The huntress warrior woman Atalanta doesn't usually appear in the long epics, but is so frequently referenced elsewhere as an Argonaut that the long versions make excuses for why she's not on board. Originally, I had intended to cover both of the most relevant versions of the Argonautica today, the more famous one by Apollonius and the Orphic version. Unfortunately, the only English translation of the Orphic Argonautica was only published a few months ago, costs $130, is currently checked out from the only library nearby, and is on back order even if I did want to buy it. I can parse through ancient Greek or French well enough to understand what is being said most of the time, but to do any detailed analysis of retroarchaic ancient poetry, I'd need a lot more time than I have to get an episode out, so that version will have to wait for the time being. That's okay, though. Covering the Apollonian Argonautica actually fits pretty nicely into our current narrative timeline. So, we begin with Jason. Jason was the son of Ison, the rightful king of Iolcus and all of Thessaly, according to myth. Ison had been deposed by Peleus, a demigod son of Poseidon and Ison's half-brother. Fleeing Peleus's wrath, Ison and his family hid their son with the centaur Chiron, who trained the would-be prince Jason to reclaim his birthright, and an oracle warned Peleus that his downfall would come from a man wearing just one sandal. Well, wouldn't you know it, Jason went to gatecrash some celebratory games hosted by Peleus when he reached adulthood, and lost his sandal in the river while helping the goddess Hera cross in disguise. He showed up and Peleus agreed to turn over the throne if Jason could complete a suicide mission to find the mythical Golden Fleece in far-off Colchis. Jason said, sure, I can do that. He contracted a man named Argus to build a ship, forever after known as the Argo, and went back to Chiron to ask which of the many mythic heroes in Greece should come aboard to help him out. After getting everyone on board, the crew of heroes gathered to elect the leader, and the men unanimously chose Heracles, because he was literally Heracles, the future god of being a badass hero. However, in possibly the only act of outright humility and grace in his whole mythos, Heracles turns down the position and insists that Jason lead the quest instead. Because, you know, it was his quest in the first place. So they had a party. But Jason started having doubts, and when one of the crew accused him of cowardice, it almost sparked a gigantic, heroic brawl before they could even set sail. Orpheus stepped in before things could go too far and began playing the lute and singing something that is implied to be one of his more famous songs, about the Theogony, the creation of the universe and the birth of the gods, then about the Titanomachy, the war between the popular gods of historical Greece and their mythic predecessors, the Titans, for dominion over the earth. The song charmed the Argonauts and compelled them to call for a toast to Zeus before heading straight to bed. Then, in the morning, they all got up, boarded the Argo, and set out. As they sailed, Orpheus struck up another tune on the lyre, this time a steady beat to help the rowers keep time together. Basically, an ancient Greek sea shanty. According to Apollonius, Chiron cantered down to the sea with his wife, who was carrying the infant son of one of the Argonauts. Peleus, the father of Achilles, who had left his child in Chiron's care for training, which would one day carry that boy to the Trojan War. For the next few days, they slowly made their way across the Aegean Sea, stopping overnight on a few islands, each with their own episodic adventure. The most famous in Book 1 is probably when they stop on the all-female island of Lemnos, where the women killed all of the men and the queen immediately fell in love with Jason when a new batch of men arrived on the island. After several days on a Love Island, the few Argonauts who stayed on the ships got tired, and Heracles marched into town to scold his fellow heroes. No sooner had they departed Lemnos than Orpheus suggested they make a pit stop on Samothrace, an island where they practiced secretive religious rites that offered protection to sailors. These rites worshipped a group of very secretive, underdwelling gods called the Kabiri, as part of a mystery cult dedicated to the god Hephaestus. This was a cult practice spreading rapidly through the Greek world during the Hellenistic era, though it probably originated with some sort of Phoenician or Phrygian tradition. Apollonius piously refused to go into more detail, and for all we know, was likely a member of the Hephaestian mysteries himself. Once again, Orpheus had invoked some secretive religious knowledge to help the Argonauts on their journey. Go figure, their next stop also involves arcane religious knowledge, although this time it was actually Jason leading the way. They passed through the Hellespont and landed at Bear Mountain, ruled by King Cyzicus, who would later lend his name to a city built on that spot. For the time being, though, they fought some giants, then got into a confused melee where Jason killed Cyzicus, leading to his widow's suicide. Jason was very sorry about it, and helped everyone work through their grief with religion. Local tradition credited Jason with introducing the Cyzicians to the cult of the Mother Goddess, who the Greeks identified as the Titan Rhea, although in Anatolia it more accurately referred to the local goddess Kubale. But religious innovation was happening, and there was only one man to help. Orpheus, who composed a hymn to the Mother Goddess, which Apollonius claims was still in use by the cult of Rhea at Cyzicus during the Hellenistic period. Apparently, this hymn was accompanied by young men dancing in full armor, bashing their swords and shields together to the music to ward off bad omens. A sort of Phrygian haka, credited to the Greek bard. So they continued on, and to make sure Heracles didn't steal too much of the spotlight, the son of Zeus got a side quest. His, handsome young companion, read uncomfortably young boyfriend, Hylas, was kidnapped by a water nymph. So Heracles and one of the other Argonauts kidnapped a bunch of local children to force their relatives to join in the manhunt. It turns out that this was all the work of the gods, to get those local villagers to settle on the future site of Trachis, Chius, and Polyphemus. This probably tied into a separate myth about Heracles and company that just has not been preserved in as much detail. Before long, they crossed the Hellespont and reached the Gulf of Olbianus, modern Izmit, and the kingdom of the Bebrukians. The local king immediately demanded to fight one of the Argonauts in a boxing match. He did not even ask who they were. This was just something the king did with all new arrivals for some reason. So Pollux, another son of Zeus, beat the king to death with his bare hands in the ring, prompting a skirmish between the Argonauts and the Bebrycian guards. Fair enough, I guess. The Bebrycians promptly descended into internecine conflict, while the Argonauts stole a bunch of sheep and used bay leaves as a substitute for traditional laurel wreaths when they held a floating celebration for Pollux's victory. This, of course, features a hymn that Orpheus seemingly made up on the spot, celebrating another son of Zeus for a job well done. Again, this is implied to be the origin of a known hymn in the Hellenistic era. From there, the adventure continued as the Argo crossed through the Dardanelles and began following the coast of the Black Sea toward the Thracian town of Thunius. Along the way, the winged Boread brothers fought some harpies, and the Argonauts caught a glimpse of the god Apollo traveling north. In praise, Orpheus taught his comrades a hymn to the god that he had learned from a triad of honeybee nymphs during his many travels. Again, this story is just a series of ancient Greek myth cameos strung together. They continued on past the future site of Heraclea Pontica, where the local king was very happy about the Argonauts disrupting the Bebrycian kingdom, and they stopped by the tomb of the late hero Sithenelus. He had once helped Heracles fight the Amazon warrior women. When Sithenelus' ghost appeared to them, Orpheus performed a ceremony to dedicate his lyre to Apollo. How exactly that worked if the lyre was already a gift from Apollo is not explained, because it is mostly a story to explain why there was a town in that spot several hundred years later called Lyra. That's actually the last we hear about Orpheus for quite a while. The dedication of his lyre is about three quarters of the way through Book 2, and Orpheus does not reappear by name until most of the way through the fourth and final book of Apollonius's epic. The Argonauts continued on, visiting Sinope, narrowly avoiding a battle with the Amazons, and eventually finding themselves on the shores of Colchis, a very real ancient kingdom on the eastern side of the Black Sea. At this point, the gods get significantly more involved. Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite conspire to convince Eros, better known by his Roman name Cupid, to make the princess of Colchis fall in love with Jason. This princess was Medea. Also, notably, a witch priestess of Hecate, the goddess of magic. Her father, King Aeetes, was the son of the solar god Helios, and Aeetes was so outraged that Jason and co. had the audacity to ask for his golden fleece that he almost ordered their execution on the spot. Instead, he challenged Jason to perform a series of near-impossible tasks that only a demigod like Aeetes himself could complete, which Jason reluctantly agreed to. I don't know why he couldn't have pawned this job off on one of the many, many demigods in his crew, but regardless. Medea had a dream about doing the tasks for him and woke up all conflicted about betraying her father and helping this strange foreigner who she had fallen in love with. Eventually, she gave in to her feelings, whipped up a potion to help, and they had a secret quickie outside of Medea's temple. The next day, Jason stepped off of the Argo with Medea's magic to back him up, and successfully completed all three tasks. Aeetes immediately started trying to figure out how to keep the golden fleece and go back on his deal. Medea warned the Argonauts and helped them steal the fleece anyway before fleeing with the Colchians in hot pursuit over the waves. Medea went with the Argonauts and helped use her magic to kill her own half-brother. This angered Zeus, who condemned the Argonauts to get lost on their way home, leading to Book 4 becoming something of an Odyssey-esque adventure around the Mediterranean, even featuring some of the same characters, like the witch Circe. This also provides a great excuse for Apollonius to not have to dredge up a bunch of extra places in the Black Sea to set his story. Eventually, this led them all the way to the Tyrrhenian Sea, the section of the Mediterranean west of Italy, where Orpheus reappears by name to help combat their most musical opponents, the Sirens. Better known for their appearance in the Odyssey, where Odysseus and his crew stuff their ears with wax, the Argonauts took a different tactic to avoid the siren song. Orpheus simply drowned them out with an even more powerful melody, and only a single Athenian hero was enticed to fall overboard. Even then, he was whisked away by Aphrodite, the goddess of love herself, to become one of her paramours in Sicily. Again, I assume this is a tie-in to another well-known myth of the time, which has been lost. The next major stop was on Drepane, known today as the island of Corfu, on the western coast of Greece. There, the Argonauts encounter another Colchian fleet, still hunting for Medea and the Golden Fleece. The local king offered to mediate and planned to hand Medea over to her family because she was an unmarried woman who ran away from her father. So, Jason and Medea go to a cave on the island and have a secret wedding with the Argonauts as their witnesses. Of course, since they had the greatest musician priest in the world, Orpheus performed the ceremony. Then, they draped their marriage bed in the golden fleece itself, and the king of Drepane told the Colchians that his hands were tied. The Colchians, now pretty far from home themselves, just kind of shrugged and decided they would be Greek now, building a new town nearby. Despite being so close to home, the Argo was blown off course again because Zeus was still angry, and they landed in Africa, where the heroes were met by three nymphs who instructed them to carry the ship overland toward Egypt. Before setting out, Orpheus needed to remind them that he was a bard cleric multi-class, since it had been a while without important religious events. He led the crew in prayer to interpret the will of the gods and wish for luck and relief on their journey. Eventually, they reached a lake where the sea god Triton gave them directions toward the sea, and they made a stopover on Crete, where they established a new shrine and faced off against the brass giant Talos, with Medea using magic to beat the metal automaton. Orpheus makes his last appearance in the Argonautica on the island of Anaphe, where they made an offering to Apollo, asking him to guide them on the final leg of the journey home, establishing a festival dedicated to the god both there and on the neighboring island of Aegina, before finally returning to the Greek mainland. However, the Argonauts' actual return to Greece isn't covered in Apollonius's work. Not to leave you on a cliffhanger, even with the fleece, Jason's uncle wouldn't yield the throne, and Medea helped assassinate him. Jason eventually rejected Medea, even after everything she had done for him, including bearing several children. So she murdered their shared sons and Jason's new wife, then ran away on a chariot drawn by dragons. Jason did reclaim his kingdom, but he died alone and grumpy when the rotting hulk of the Argo collapsed on him. Orpheus, meanwhile, returned to his religious travels and or performance tour around the Greek world, and was credited with a bit of a playboy rockstar lifestyle along the way. Two Athenian heroes were supposedly his sons, Musaeus, the most famous Athenian priest and poet, who was a sort of local Orpheus himself, and Leon, supposedly the progenitor of one of Athens' aristocratic clans. Yet, even Orpheus wanted to settle down eventually. He met and quickly fell in love with a beautiful woman named Eurydice, sometimes portrayed as half-nymph, and for a time they were happy together. How long that time was depends on the author. Eurydice danced and enjoyed her husband's music in the fields. Then one day, tragedy struck. Different versions have different details, but not long after their marriage, Eurydice was dancing with nymphs and was fatally bitten by a snake. Crushed by the grief of her death, Orpheus played such a mournful, powerful song that it opened up a path into the underworld itself. There, the bard descended into the world of the dead. He was determined to negotiate with the ruler of the underworld, Hades, and bring Eurydice back to life. He lulled the three-headed dog, Cerberus, to sleep with music and demanded an audience with Hades and Persephone, where he played such a beautiful song that even the stoic Hades was moved. The Lord of the Dead offered a deal. Orpheus could just walk right out of the underworld with Eurydice behind him, but if he ever turned around to make sure she was really there, Eurydice's soul would be swept back into the lands of the dead. Just before reaching the exit, the anxiety of it all overwhelmed Orpheus, and he glanced back, only to see his one true love whisked off to death forevermore. And try as he might, Orpheus was never able to get back into Hades to try again. He became one of the only mortals in Greek mythology to venture into the underworld and return alive, if in bittersweet fashion. Traditionally, this is one of ancient Greece's many stories about the dangers of hubris, a hero reaching such great heights that they think they can do the impossible and being struck down by the will of the gods. Still distraught by his loss, Orpheus played a song of mourning so gut-wrenching, wishing for his own death, that either Zeus or the raw forces of nature simply struck him down and allowed Orpheus to join Eurydice. Though in classical tradition, his lyre was preserved in the stars as the constellation Lyra. And that is the tale of Orpheus, a man who played music and sang hymns so powerful that he could sway both the gods and nature itself, and whose songs of praise and worship were thought of as cornerstones of Greek religious life across the Hellenistic world. Next time, we will dive deeper into the actual theology around those songs and traditions. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.